Poetry is so long, and he stretched it out, he made it work, he made the melody work on and on through the line.
Mm. Have you heard his Indian Queen?
Not really.
Oh, that's a good bunch. It's like a romanticization, whatever, of the noble savage thing, but it's got some great songs where the Indian, right. The Indian king goes, "What flattering noise is this that makes my snakes all hiss?"
That's great.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Poet Radio, March 2023 edition. Tonight I'm with David Cope, a poet who is a lifelong resident of Michigan and is someone who is very important to me as I was getting my feet wet in the world of poetry and poetics. Dave and I met when he came to do a poetry reading and to lead a class when I was a student at Naropa Institute, Boulder, Colorado, in the summer of 1986, and we'll partly be going back to that time in this program. Dave's the author of several books of poetry, including Quiet Lives, Fragments from the Stars, Coming Home, and other titles. He edits the magazine Big Scream, which has been an ongoing project for decades, and he recently edited A Bridge Across the Pacific anthology, and even more recently, I believe, in 2022, he published a fabulous collection, David Cope and Allen Ginsberg Correspondence 1976-1996, which compiles letters between he and Ginsberg during that period, as well as providing commentary and other documentation relating to his interactions with Ginsberg. We'll start the program by talking about that and move on to hearing Dave read his poems and discuss other projects. So we began the show tonight with a snippet taken from a late night recording I made in the summer of 1987 in Boulder, in which Steven Taylor, a musician who served as Ginsberg accompanist, was playing archaic melodies, and we all joined in with our voices, comments, and riffs, and including Alan. Something of a blast from the past, and I thought it'd be a nice way to start the program. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you.
Well, that was definitely brought back memories hearing you singing along with Steven. And what was your impression of hearing that recording after so many years?
Well, it was 18 minutes out of about a 3 or 4 hour session where we just yakked and carried on. There was a point, I think, later on where we, Steven had all these lyric sheets and he had enough for all of us that were there. It was an interesting situation because Alan had been injured when his lover, Peter Orlovsky, had one of his, I don't know if fits would be the right word, but he sometimes went a little crazy. And Alan tried to calm him down and was holding him, and Peter threw him on the ground, not knowing what he was doing. And Alan injured his thigh. So he's in the middle of his apartment floor, lying on his stomach, with a towel across his butt. He's bare naked otherwise. And there was a young girl who was massaging the sore spots for him as we gathered around him and sang and did these songs.
Yeah.
It was kind of a crazy time. When Stephen was sufficiently happy, we kind of went through songs by John Dowland and Thomas Campion, and they were all people from Shakespeare's time. I think he did a couple of Shakespeare songs too, and a few that he threw in from somebody else.
Yeah.
So it's sort of interesting where Alan was given the bass part, quite obviously, because he had the lowest voice. And then each of the rest of us, Stephen assigned us roles, and we learned to sing it together. And sometimes we'd go through two or three times to get it right. Of course, he was a master guitar player and eventually got his PhD at Brown University and worked at Naropa for a while. I think he's back in New York now. That's what my memory was of it. And what was odd was in the 18 minutes, he did do the Willow song, which was Desdemona's death song in Othello. And so that's a Shakespeare song. And then he also did a song by John Dowland.
Well, one thing I think we can say for sure is that Alan brought, you know, people together, a lot of people together in different ways. So that's a sort of the prime example of that. And he was so supportive to many young writers, including you. Your book of letters with Ginsberg is incredible. And I'm so glad to have a chance to talk with you about it. Glad that you put this personal literary time capsule together. And maybe talk a little bit about how it came about and your process of assembling it.
Yeah. Okay, so we got to start with Alan's letters. I had known for a long time that my letters were at Stanford, and I knew what boxes they were in. You could look it right up at Stanford's, finding aids. So I wasn't going to worry about it because I was too busy with 10,000 other things. It wasn't just Big Scream. It was all the other shit that happens in a poetry career. And finally, I reached a point where I thought, okay, I'm going to go through all of my Xeroxes of the postcards that Alan sent me and letters that Alan sent me, and which I had in my archive at Michigan, because I thought it was a better place for them than my attic, which sometimes gets up to 90 degrees in the summertime. Not good for paper. And so I went through it. And of course, his scribbles are worse than mine. And I was having a hell of a time. You know, I had this brackets where I put it in there, illegible. And what happened was I started talking to people like Bill Morgan, Peter Hale, a little bit with Bob Rosenthal, and others who were more familiar with his handwriting than mine. And we got rid of most of the troubled words. And so that was good. But then when I wrote to the librarian email at Stanford and said, what would it cost to send me all of my letters of Xeroxes or something of them so that I could assemble them in a book? And the guy wrote back and said, oh, this is nothing. I'll give it to you for free and I'll send it to you in about five or six PDFs. So it came back and it was 350 some pages of my stuff, including poems that I had rejected and thrown away because they weren't any good. And lots of other stuff, first drafts of poems that became important and so on. But there was a big problem. One was, when I was young and stupid, I didn't put my a date on any of them. And so I would send those to Alan, and the kids in his office, I'm sure you remember that, kids in his office would try to file them in a folder for me. And they were guessing at the dates. And sometimes the dates were as much as 9 or 10 years off. Good example. The letter after John Lennon's death on December 8, 1980, included a poem that I never published. It was about him and his influence on my life. And they had filed it in the 1988-1989 section. So what I did is I started placing them back where they belonged and giving them an approximate date. And then I would have to go through as I went on. There's another example of a really bad one. There was a letter from an Italian hotel that was, I guess, Gregory Corso cussing out Peter Orlovsky about calling him every goddamn name in the book. And I would never say anything like that. Peter was always good to me, for one thing. And secondly, I don't like to engage in that kind of argumentation. And I told the Stanford guy, and he said, well, that's probably true, but I can't. Our library's rules say that you can't change it once the author has okayed the letters as they are. And so I immediately got a hold of Peter Hale and Peter and Bill Morgan and others. And I made copies of the Corso letter. And I assumed that it probably because Corso comes right after Cope alphabetically. They probably meant to dump it in the Corso file, but somehow it got into mine.
Yeah.
Anyways, and I knew it wasn't anything I wrote because I've never been to Italy. But though I would love to go to Florence and a couple other places. Ravenna would be the one. I want to go to Dante's tomb. But at any rate, Bill and Peter, and I can't remember that. It's in the book somewhere where I named one of who are the ones that helped me. They got a hold of the librarian. They said, look, this cannot possibly be his. You've got to make an exception.
Oh, I know that. That's a good story.
So they dumped it out. Anyways. Well, then I had the problem of, okay, I got all these letters roughly in given years, according to their internal evidence. And I had to find a way to find corresponding facts or statements in Alan's letters to what I was saying in mine. And I could line them up that way, where this one was obviously a response to that one, if that makes sense. So I went through quite a wrangle on that. It was kind of a fun detective story when you get right down to it. And I got those laid out at that point in time. And then I had to go through the process of how do I describe what we do with this group of letters. I wrote an introduction describing it as sort of a Bildungsroman, a young poet who finds his way through the guidance of a wise mentor. And it starts that way. I was young in the first section, Getting to Know You, the 1976 to 1980. I was young, and Alan saw that I was gifted, and that I sort of came from the Williams-Reznikoff school, objectivism and imagism and so on. We immediately began sort of feeling each other out. He wanted to know how I made my money. I told him I was a janitor, because I was. And I'd been a factory worker. And I began asking him about what books he was reading. And that caused all through the whole book, you can see it. There's, what are you reading now? And we would talk it back and forth. Sometimes he would be over explaining, like there's the one letter that I think it's American Airlines letter that I had Pan Am or something on there. Maybe it was the other way around. where he spent about 4 or 5 pages on the plane explaining Blake's Four Zoas to me, not knowing that I already knew all that stuff. And I didn't make a big deal out of it. I just said, yeah, that sounds pretty good. You've done a nice job. We went on from there. But and he was confessed at one time that at age 55 he had finally read Milton. He'd never read him before. And I thought, God, that's kind of interesting, because when I was at Michigan, we took Blake and Coleridge and Wordsworth, I think it was, or something like that. Most of it was about Blake because the professor was crazy about him. I got an A in that class for sure, because that was right up my alley. Ah, Sunflower, weary of time. But anyways, I went on to Milton the following year. I figured Blake was building some of his longer lines out of like a massive fortress, 14 to 15 syllables per line. It was like, and Milton had done the same, except that Milton was a little more refined in it. And I always felt Blake was right, you know, that Milton was a true poet because he wrote in chains when speaking of God and Jesus and free as a bird when it was the devil. And of course, the book two of that poem is really interesting. But so the book discussions that we kind of had were sort of like, he was, I think, trying to figure out how much does this kid know? And I have a really comprehensive background all through the Romans and Greeks, as well as all the other stuff. I didn't go for this shit about take creative writing and forget literature. When I went to grad school, it was recommended that you get an MFA, and I thought, that's bull. I went to the lit community, and I thought, I want to know everything I can about Dante and Shakespeare and Chaucer. They're my three of the older guys. They're my favorites. Yeah, and I wound up becoming a Shakespeare teacher as a result. I would have taught Dante because I knew him well enough, but I was teaching at a community college, and Dante is really graduate level, especially if you're, even if you're only working through translations, it's graduate level stuff to get it right, because he has so many layers that those poems have in them. Anyways.
So once Alan had gotten a sense of who you were, he became really supportive of your work, and he introduced you to so many people, and that type of community building is really one of the primary things that also emerges in the book. And
I think he learned that, strangely enough, from Ezra Pound.
Yeah.
Pound did the same thing. He rewrote The Wasteland for Eliot and cut half of it out. And he kind of shepherded Eliot for a time. And then when the Objectivists came out, Reznikov, Rakosi, and Oppen, and what's the other guy? I can't remember. Anyways, they had the Objectivist issue of Poetry Magazine in 1930, where Pound made the selections and wrote a description of what Objectivism was. And he was basically working on what he saw in Reznikov's work. Karl Rakosi said, I never much cared for being considered an objectivist. I consider myself a realist. I like to get myself in there sometimes. Yeah. I thought that was pretty funny. He had a terrific sense of humor. Yeah. So anyways, that first section of the book was getting to know you. The second section, 1980 to 1989, was beginning to figure out ways to work together. In a very good way. I mean, it starts with the 1987 Objectivist Conference, which was not my doing. I just jumped on board because they asked me, and I got to meet Marie Serkin, Reznikov's widow, and I got Carl, which was a high point in my life. I think you saw that one.
We're leading into it, yeah. David. We're going to revisit that event. Maybe before we do that, I just, again, wanted to say that the example of correspondence in the book is, before the age of email and internet, I mean, it's really kind of a shining example of what a valuable practice that is.
And, documentation. That was what it was all about for me. And, especially when we got to the part, the intense finale in that book, where I wrote a couple of really long letters to Jim Cohn about the closing the Bardo ceremony at Hill Auditorium at U of M, where Alan came every year to read his poems. 1994, 95, and 96, he read first Howlin', the first one, along with some less poems. Then Kaddish, the second. And the third, he had like some newer poems. And he was getting ready to come and read in 97 too. He had Patti Smith as his backup, and she was coming out of retirement. And the first year that she played with her band, they weren't very good. I remember Carmen Bougon, my student poet friend, who is now a PhD from Oxford, she didn't like it at all. And I said, well, Patti has been retired. She's kind of, but what was odd was the second and third year, she kicked ass. Let me tell you, she was great. And I was very much happy to do that. Of course, at the closing the Bardo ceremony, Patti closed it. There were people like Well, Anne Waldman, for one, she was incredible at that. I've never seen her so good. And Bob Rosenthal read some of Allen's last poems, and they selected me to do my elegy for Allen. So I got up and did it. And that was the first time I'd heard myself called one of Allen's heart songs, which I was really pleased about.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Andy Foster and Antler and me. So I went back to the hotel room afterwards, and I recorded everything exactly as it happened right then, because I knew that my memory would fade and be a little less a little more hazy. So those two letters to Jim, the one is the closing the Bardo ceremony, they're precise in terms of recording what I actually experienced within a few hours of it happening. And the same thing is true of the second one, which was when I came back to Naropa in 1998. What had happened to it after Alan was gone? And I had some good times for that one, too. I met with Steve Taylor, and we sang all kinds of songs together in his backyard.
As I said at the beginning of the program, we're spending a bit of time in the past, and then we're going to move on to something more like the present. But I did, before we get too off track, I wanted to go over the, just to say that, another event that happened during that summer in Naropa was a reading you did with Carl Riccosi. And unfortunately, I actually missed that reading by just a few hours, and remember hearing about how it was a great occasion. And thanks to the Internet Archive, it's available for anyone to hear online. So I selected a poem of yours from that night, which I wanted to play for the intense and everyday scene it depicts, the true description of birth. And then I want to play a couple of poems by Riccosi as well from that night. Dave, I noticed that you didn't read the title of this particular poem at the event, but maybe you want to do that now?
Well, the original title was Jane Marie. She was born in 1987, and all three of my kids were C-section kids, and my wife was called the miracle C-section because she would be up and walking around the entire hospital corridors on the first night. She would have her little, water bag or whatever the hell it was. Salt water bag.
Yeah.
They told her they wanted her to take a few steps, and she's a tyrant. What would you call it? A titan, even though she's very small. She would go all the way around the entire hospital floor she was on each night. And the nurses called her the miracle C-section. Jane grew up, of course, went to U of M, got summa cum laude. She had a 4.0 average, which is rare at Michigan. And then later went to Paris, where she went to Université Paris-8, which is the major French university for French feminism. And she got her master's degree there. 120-page paper in academic French, just absolutely stunning. They gave her the highest grades they could ever give a student. And eventually, after 6 years, she got tired of Paris and came back here. Absolutely hated Granville, which is a right-wing community that's enough to make you want to barf sometimes, even though it's a nice place to live for raising kids. Good schools. She went to Chicago and decided she wanted to live within 6 blocks of Lake Michigan, which I understand thoroughly, and liked the town because you could get around without driving. She has no driver's license. Well, anyways, about a year or two ago, I can't remember for sure right now, she always knew that she was queer and had no interest in boys at all. Eventually, hooked up with friends who were trans and so on, and decided that she wanted to change her name. So the name of the poem is not Jane Marie anymore. It's now Alex Jane. And her preferred pronouns are they and them, or possessive act, whatever. Preferred words are they and them and themselves and also on. And I've had no problem with the Alex Jane because it's treated like a what would you call it, a nickname almost. And sometimes you just want to Alex. Trying to get used to the pronoun or the change in pronouns and possessive adjectives is a little different for someone that's been an English teacher for 22 years. So I had a hell of a time with it, but I guess we're getting through it.
And, great. Well, let's I'm gonna play the poem. This is from 1987 at Naropa.
Under my hand, moist forehead, Sue looks up. The doctor's cut through flesh wall, fat layer, still deeper. Their gloves redden with her blood. She is purely calm, her calm becoming mine. And now the doctor's hand enters her abdomen. The aide pushes, pushes. A blue head appears, wrinkled, angrily drawing breath. A howl as the whole blue body appears. Cut and clamp, weigh and check and suck out nostrils. Hand her to the father, me, who sits amazed as blue flesh turns slowly pink, Sue's hand reaching to touch.
Yeah, it's such a great poem. And while we're at that evening, we're going to play these poems by Carl Riccosi just to put some more context into your own work and also shine a little light on Carl's work, which you don't hear about so much these days.
Yeah, in fact, when we talked about that, I thought, my God, here's an opportunity to put Carl back into the stream.
Many of you are old, or maybe some of you are old enough to remember the old Army recruiting poster, which I used to see everywhere. Uncle Sam, the top hat and leaning forward. Uncle Sam needs you. And this poem is Love America. Uncle Sam needs you. I can love a dog, but a whole country with interests bigger than death? You gotta be kidding. That way, Uncle, you mean to use me. Instructions to the player. Cellist, easy on that bow. Not too much weeping. Remember that the soul is easily agitated and has a terror of shapelessness. It will venture out, but only to a doe's eye. Let the sound out inner misterioso, but from a distance, like the forest at night. And do not forget the pause between. That is the sweetest and has the nature of infinity.
I always liked how Ginsberg classified the objectivist as being sane, and in introducing Riccosi at this reading, he commented on his quote human clarity of American place, and I thought maybe you have a comment on the objectivist cause.
Well, he did not consider himself an objectivist. He said he came out and said that's describing Charles Reznikoff. He preferred realist.
Yeah.
And one of the things about his writing is it has an enormous sense of humor.
Yeah.
He knows how to turn a phrase in a way where it's ironic, but it's, sometimes it's like getting his licks in too. And I've always loved his Americana poems because they catch ordinary people in the oddest moments of their lives. Excuse me, sir. Never fails when I got to read. I wind up getting a frog in my throat. I could give you the last of my singing fathers if you want.
I mean, from Rakosi?
No, it's my poem.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, I mean, that's, we're going to move into, yeah, let's, we can move into hearing your poems. I want to do that.
Yeah, okay.
One last question, Joe, though. And were you at or did you know about that famous poetry conference that brought a lot of those guys together? In
I was there.
Oh, you went? You were at the Objectivist? Oh, great.
Not the Objectivist conference. It was the National Poetry Festival at Grand Valley State College, which is now a university, about 30 miles from my house.
So you were introduced to them in a very young...
Well, them and a bunch of other people. Ken Rexroth was there. You can actually see a lot of the guys in the book. Rakosi was there. Reznikoff was teaching. Robert Duncan made an enormous impression on me at the time. I really loved that guy. I'm incredibly erudite, but at the same time, very sweet and kind. And Duncan was funny. He would give these lectures that would lead you around in a big circle where he's going from point to point to point to point, and you don't know it, but he's actually leading you right back to where he began.
Yeah.
And he would get to the end of his lecture, and he said, "I need to have you make a promise to me that you will stay here 5 minutes after I have left, because I want to be the first one in the cafeteria for the cottage cheese." Huh? Michigan has really wonderful cottage cheese.
That's funny.
he seemed to have a thing about that, but. Yeah, I saw all those guys. I saw the if you go to the book, I remember what page it's on at this point, but it's early. All the early ones are from that festival. Alan with his squeeze box, and there's Rakosi. Reznikoff in the garden teaching students. There's a wonderful shot of Robert Duncan speaking with Reznikoff, Oppen, and Rakosi. And if you notice that in that picture, it's on page 13. Duncan is holding forth, and Rakosi is listening attentively, and Reznikoff scratching his head like, "What do I make of those?" That was pretty funny. But there's others too. I thought it was important to start with that because that's where I met all those guys. That's where I got my... what would you say? My education about poetry beyond my home state. Wow, you know, I had Robert Hayden for my teacher at Michigan, and I'm very thankful for that. A great black poet, one of the greatest poets of the 20th century for my money. But it doesn't give you the whole panoply of outrider poets and poets who are different, that don't necessarily fit into the academic mode. And this conference did. So I'm very thankful for that. It opened my eyes to a lot of different styles, and I began experimenting further from what I had already been doing.
Right on, right on. Well, it's just so many things that we could talk about, but why don't we go ahead and now move towards your poems, having you read some poems, and if we have more time, we'll go back to the past.
Sure, that's fine.
I'm looking forward to it. Very good.
I'll start with the March Blessing, I guess. You want me to just run right through all of them?
Yeah, why not? Okay. I want to remind listeners they're in tune to WGXC Poet Radio. We're with David Cope this evening, and here he's going to read some of his poems.
Okay, A March Blessing, and this is an interesting one for me. I'm still editing my collected poems, and I noticed that A March Blessing wasn't in there. And I thought, Jesus, there's each of my kids has something. There's their birth poems and then other poems where they figure. And the March Blessing was the one where I took Will, who was my youngest, down to the river to show him what it was. And so I worked on the things that I sent you. yesterday, all the different things that you had requested. I found a way to squirrel this poem and one other one into the coming home section. I thank you for that. I got to redo all the page numbers and such, but that's okay. A March blessing. Sun sparkled floodwaters, glassy calm. Thousands of saplings bent at flood line, straightened to run at the sky. Fallen trees are draped with flotsam, leaves and sticks and styrofoam cups, papers and wrappers blown from the highway. The old mounds are islands now. Ancient spirits sing in this land above their bones and flooded skulls. First buds swell, great ravens stare from the high branches. The wind is just warm and fresh enough to turn a busy traveler's head and fill his dream with lazy song. Hear that falling water now, so I dream of you long gone. Recall you racing naked paths and count you still as one with me here silently as I bring my son to this shore for the first time to see the wild flights of birds and know the tracks and signs in sand. Hear that open, quiet melody. Breathe that breath of river's blessing, that calm and rising, falling flow. Two notes. The ancient mounds are Hopewell mounds, burial mounds along the Grand River, which in the original language was the Owashtenon River. They're sort of protected, but they're kept right, they're right near the freeway, so you hear that this noise there, and it is sacred ground to this day. I ride through there on my bike a lot. There's a quiet road on the other side closer to the river which goes right by them, and there are times when I swear the spirits are with me when I come through. They're watching me. The other one is the So I Dream of You Long Gone. This was my friend Todd McIntyre that died way too young. We used to all strip naked and when we were teenagers, when we had our cabin up in the woods that we had built. We would get drunk, go swimming, run naked on the paths in the woods at night, and find our way to raspberry things where we'd have raspberry juice dribbling down our chins so that we were stealing raspberries. So that's the background on that one. So there's a lot of death in the poem, in spite of the fact that it's a living poem too. Hope that makes sense.
Well, it's we're in March. I thought that's a nice one. And
both my daughter Alex and my son William were born in March, and I asked my wife Suzanne to marry me on the Ides of March in front of the Michigan Union. Caesar was killed that night. Okay. This is The Rain. It's a very early poem that was never published, but which I revised when I was making this collection. I have a whole bunch of early poems that have never seen the light of day. And I thought I'd do the same thing that Alan did. I was sort of following his lead by putting the early poems up in the front. Some of them are not as well formed as others, but I also revised a lot of them so they'd have a little more kick to them. This is The Rain, in memoriam Charles Reznikoff, who was the first of my singing fathers. Looking for it, silence is nowhere. The knife blade scrapes on the cutting board. Children shriek across the meadow. The sad news reaches me. This gray morning has made me turn again. Now the rain gusts over the pavement. Another is gone. The old poet whose steely voice shook compassion from sorrow, celebrated the worker's endurance, the delicate heart, even in irony. When I'm full of sadness, the wind comes to me. Where there's sorrow, let me be there. The one that brought me the news was Alan. It's in the letters. You know, last Reznikoff was dead. When I had asked him to send the chat book, The Stars, to Charles. And it's odd. Alan mentions the apartments that he was in. I looked it up on the map of New York, and it's on the west side of New York. They're still there. Resi had a really interesting one when Allen had left the room in the 1973 thing. They got talking about him, the older guys. And he said, that guy is something else. He said, there was one time I was carrying suitcases across the park to get back home after I'd been somewhere. And Allen saw me there, grabbed the suitcases and carried them. And he talked poetry to me all the way home. I always thought that was very fitting. You know, the younger poet carries the suitcases while trying to get wisdom from the older. It was an interesting thing. I don't think I know if that's what Charles meant, but it sure as hell fit the bill for me. I've always had that feeling that one must serve one's time of semi-apprenticeship, even if you don't share the style of the person that you're learning from.
Sure.
This is the return. The silent winds whirl under Condor's wing, up valleys where bison calves leap and coyotes prowl, around redwoods and up concrete canyons, among Wall Street pillars, past saxophones wailing on 42nd Street, around the lovers in red-trimmed peasant black reclining on grass above the sunlit spray of Patterson Falls, beyond the still racing baseball players, millennia pass in falling water. Whole families walk away from homes they knew where they grew. A woman wipes her eyes at the edge of her husband's newly dug grave. Many nights I've walked these dreams away. Lovers and friends returning in winds at dawn. I started out west and came east. The lovers in red trim peasant black were at Patterson Park when I went there with James Ruggio and Bob Rickson. And the still racing baseball players are the ball players on page 54, I think it is, of Patterson Williams' great poem. So that's that one. The Carl Rakosi poem, the last of my singing fathers. Resi was my first, Carl was my last. I love George Oppen too. I don't want to take anything away from him. That Of Being Numerous is a great poem. Last of my singing fathers, in memoriam, Carl Rakosi. Past, dead, you might say, not one to mince words. The century gone to bed with you, Carl, quietly, proud to be Charles, churl, free man, beholden to none. Standing with laborers on the street, no poet sitting on his exquisite ass. At 80, reciting your epic elegy on the decline and last days of your word brother, George Oppen, you demanded only silence from your audience, reciting lines into the darkness that we all breathe together more deeply, into the unmeasured silence that the voice itself find its own inner rhythm, dissolve, a heartbeat. Aged sailor, afloat among endless stars and winds, no regrets, bemused, surprised, aware. You were amused, too, when Allen Ginsberg gave us oatmeal and seaweed breakfast, then took a call and castigated his caller, who would have cut his balls off, blaming his religion. Bright morning across the kitchen table, bowl of fruit, open door, and breeze among potentillas beyond. So, Carl, I salute you, old friend who signed me ally when we read together, who later recommended the Sephardic poets of Spain and touched on the Jewish eagle in thought. Last of my singing fathers, small wrists, fine eyes, gentle touch, yet firm and kind.
Yeah.
That actually was true, though. We had breakfast. Allen, Carl, and I went during that Objectivist conference. We had breakfast together every morning. Allen would bring out the strangest foods that Carl didn't know what the hell to make them. It was like, you know, that old cereal commercial to get Mikey to do it. I was Mikey. I would try it, and he'd say, "Well, what do you think?" I said, "Well, it's a little salty, but it'll do." Boulder has terrific oatmeal. I'm half Scottish, so I know. I'm going to proceed to the two older or newer poems that are from my age, if you will. I think it's important to be honest about age. We were talking about that last night when we were watching the Academy Awards. It's important that one accept one's age and not try to, you know, cover it up. I think it's true mentally speaking, too. So many people are afraid of death. So anyways, this is a unbidden dream, a melancholy evening, calm and free. I must speak of the insistent melancholy of age, regrets lurking behind shared laughter, endless smiles. My small boat lingers in the eddies among still waters, moved only by perch, fanning slowly in shadows. I lift my head and see the blue heron above, ancient presence. The seasons roll on, the sun now obscured, now the moon, the body falling apart, gradually shutting down, memories, tales unfolding like quick films from another life, moments rising to feverish yet near silent crescendo, shared warmth in a friend's touch, radiant eyes lingering in dream. I pass through an open door in moonlight among stars and leave the grave to grave business. Dawn comes quickly. I send blessings for Zhang, wherever he may be now, his last message speaking of high blood pressure and creatinine. Now prolonged silence after completing his life's work. Dear friend, singing quietly beyond the dynamo of dreams. I am indeed surrounded by spirits day and night, old loves still palpable, present, as are the sorrows, regrets, filling the many paths with unheard silences among the busy living with their chatter and deadlines. Tonight, my kusa flowers fully, as Alan's did in years after he passed, and the clematis, which struggled years to simply climb in the orchid porch doorway, now frames it with wild open purple flowers. Here is a moment to honor the passing cortege, blindly living among the waking dead. The heart endures for now. The song rises even in this quiet moment, audible for those with ears to hear it. Chant the unbidden dream. Okay, Ukraine's a little longer. It, in some ways, is a catalog poem. I think I mentioned to you that it's really based on a meditation from my bridge across the Pacific, where I was face to face with the whole problem of human militarism. Ukraine. Ah, Ukraine. Years roll in a dead march. Saul killing thousands, David tens of thousands, Arjuna the killer spurred by Krishna. Endless wars in China, Xinjiang walking among shattered bones. Du Fu hidden in his hut, lamenting horrors he witnessed, fleeing, never to return. 100 years of killing celebrated after Agincourt. Then rockets, red glare, bombs bursting in air. Moscow shattered, Waterloo, Sumter, Gettysburg, Atlanta's flames, Richmond's ruins, Sheridan and Shenandoah, Sand Creek, Tongue River, Wounded Knee, Custer, Ypres, Verdun, the Somme, the Blitz, Coventry, Dresden, the first death, the child in London. What stirs such men? Hitler, Mussolini, Tojo, Stalin, now Putin, the KGB thug, become manic nation butcher. What rage broils in their dreams that they could act as now in the European sunflower breadbasket, forcing a good man to defiance, is people's heroism. Cities bombed to silence. Refugees in millions fleeing nightmares. What history? What twisted psyches in our human condition? What Ecce Homo shatters lives, bodies, peace, kindness, compassion? Night after night, I follow the moon walking the sky shining, wondering at such tranquility, such silence, such a gift, tossed for nightmares endless as hell's dark road, the agony of millions. Thus spoke the old man, hoping to spend his last years in peace, head in hands, sleepless nights with this hellish repetition. Again. And then the coda. So much horror in the first part, I had to make up for it. Blessing for Volodymyr Zelensky, his wife Olena, their children. Blessing for the wives and children living their nightmares, trapped on a long and dangerous road. Even crossing borders to safety, fraught with pain. Blessing for the fathers, husbands, and brothers forced to shoulder rifles, rocket launchers, Molotov cocktails, tearful by night and in quiet moments, wondering if they'll live to see their loved ones again, if indeed those they love are safe. Blessing for my poet friend, Svetlana Yukimovich, who translated the great dissident poet, Vaso Stus, dead in a Soviet prison in 1985, still celebrated for his great courage today. Blessing on the ruined cities of Ukraine that they might live again. Blessing on the Odessa Opera and Ballet Theater, the long history of cultural excellence throughout Ukraine. Blessing on the memory of Anna Akhmatova, born in Odessa, recalled now as Anna of all the Russias. Blessing on her poems, that they continue to speak truth to tyrants, that they liberate the minds and hearts of all who open her leaves, she, shining star of world poetry. Blessing on all the nations who take in the refugees, especially Poland. Feed and help them find lives beyond despair. May their families be reunited. Blessing on those praying for the nation, the people, the children, that their dreams bear fruit and touch those in need. May Ukraine rise from the ashes, free, and celebrate liberation and renewal. May the nation know liberty at last, celebrating survival in wild, whirling dance and song.
Wow, Dave. Wow, yep. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, that's from an anthology that we did locally, Busy Grief's Raw Tones. It's a poetic response to the brutality of war in Ukraine. Almost all the poets in here are local to Grand Rapids. We did not accept royalties for what we did, and the publisher would not take profits on it, so that essentially the only cost for the thing was the cost of making the books. And all of the money that was raised, that has been raised from sales of the book, is donated to the International Rescue Committee, which is sent over to Poland primarily, because that's where a lot of the Ukrainian people go when they're getting the hell out of there. And so we've raised over, I think, around 3,500 bucks now. Oh. And we continue to do that by having readings here in town.
That's great.
You know, we had to sign an agreement that we would not publish the poems anywhere this place else for a year. Oh. So I've got about 4 or 5 months, and then I'll send it out to somebody.
So great to hear it. And all of the poems, you know, so lucid and such a sensitive and true address. It's a pleasure to have.
Yeah, my first publisher, Tom Lanigan, said that he liked publishing the poems because they matter.
Yeah.
And that was a really high compliment to me, because I always wanted to have something that wasn't a puzzle to be pulled apart the way you get with some of these MFA poems.
It's okay. But,
we used to call it cardboard poetry in the indie press.
Right.
But
So what, just, you know, we're short on time now, but wondering if there's anything else you want to say about things you have upcoming, or we could just leave off there with a fine Ukraine poem.
Well, I got a lot of stuff. I'm meeting with a friend, Linda Nemec Foster, tomorrow for lunch to bring 9 copies that were purchased by a friend of mine of the anthology. She's going to be joining 5 women Polish-American poets who are going to go over to Ukraine in, I think it's June or July. They're going to meet with Polish poets, all women, and Ukrainian refugee poets, all women, and they're going to discuss what all can be done for them. Mm-hmm. The Poles have a really good pattern over there. They find jobs for the people as they come in so that they can support themselves, help them find housing and all the rest. So all those countries are kind of the crossroads of Europe. They've been trampled on by the thugs all these years, and they know how to hang together. Right. Other than that, I've got an upcoming lecture with a former student's class at an arts college where they wanted landscape poems. It's a art and design college. And I thought that'd be kind of interesting, because when you go to Chinese poetry, a lot of times they use aspects of the landscape or past history as a way to create empathy for people that would be killed if it was known that that's what the poem was about. It was an interesting sort of learning for me when I went to China of what is meant by empathy there. Right. And sometimes you can't tell the truth flat out, because you'll get killed if you do. And it was similar to Shakespeare's time. You know, Ben Jonson was a secret Catholic, and he was hauled in front of the Star Chamber and threatened to have his nose cut off and his ears cut off. I think it was his ears. Anyways, his nose cut off for a play that he had written, which has since disappeared. And of course, he gave in right then, and they were giving it to him because he wouldn't go to church on Sunday, and they kept track of who did and who didn't. Tyrannical societies, I guess is the way I'd put it. At any rate.
Dave, it's been so great to catch up with you these past days and to record your poems and tell people about the Ginsberg Correspondence. That's I don't think I mentioned that's a Giant Steps Press book.
Yes.
David Cope and Allen Ginsberg Correspondence.
Yeah.
So thanks for taking time.
Thank you. It's good to be in touch.